This is Michael Leary from the Human Research Protection Office at Washington University in St. Louis with More Than Meets the IRB. More Than Meets the IRB is a series of conversations dedicated to research participants and the people who study them. Today, I'd like to welcome back Dr. Laura Stark. Thank you for joining us again.
I'm happy to be here.
Dr. Stark, as you know, is an assistant professor in the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University and currently on sabbatical at Harvard History of Science Department. She is author of Behind Closed Doors, IRBs and the Making of Ethical Research, a book which we've discussed previously on this program. Her article titled Reading Trust Between the Lines, Housekeeping Work and Inequality in Human Subjects Review was also recently published in the Cambridge Quarterly of Healthcare Ethics. Congratulations on that publication. And that's actually the paper we'd like to talk about today. So to get us started, can you briefly summarize the paper itself and the research behind it? What exactly is IRB housekeeping work?
Well, IRB housekeeping work is perhaps one of the most mundane aspects of the everyday work of IRBs, and I also tend to find it the absolutely most interesting. What I call housekeeping work is the sorts of things like correcting grammar and typographical errors in proposals and applications, protocols, consent forms that researchers submit to IRBs and that they're reviewing either through in an expedited review process or else even in full board meetings. So let me tell you why I find housekeeping work tremendously interesting. And this was a term all of the IRBs that I studied used this term systematically of housekeeping. So it even seemed a little bit mundane to them, it would seem. But what I'm interested in studying IRBs, is to figure out how individuals have to take these abstract rules and actually do the hard work of translating them into an everyday practice, which is to say to give them a real meaning on the ground in everyday research, and it affects what we can do as a researcher myself. I know this. But the reason why housekeeping work is so important, because first of all, it takes a large amount of time. That's how a lot of IRB members spend their time. But also, it accomplishes other things than simply the on the face of it work of correcting simply sentence structure. Because what it's doing is actually allowing IRB members and administrators to figure out whether an investigator is trustworthy or not. And so this is sort of the big finding of the article, is that what IRB members end up doing is having to use documents, the material things that researchers submit to be reviewed, as a way to judge whether they're actually good quality researchers, whether they oversee their staff well enough, whether they're outsourcing or delegating too much of the work that they ought to be doing themselves. So when I talk about reading trust between the lines, essentially through housekeeping work, IRB members are trying to decide whether an investigator is somebody who's really worth trusting.
Let's talk a little bit about the difference between trust and control in this context. Very intriguing concepts here in the ethical review of research context. Your paper mentions that housekeeping, as you defined it, advantages some researchers and disadvantages others. How have you seen this pan out?
First, let me start with the concept of trustees, which is a term that I find really useful from sociologist and legal scholar Susan Shapiro. And what she calls trustees are types of groups of people, organizations within bigger institutions, just like IRBs, that are actually put in place to ensure that what the institution itself is doing actually will look okay to the rest of the outside world. So trustees are essentially the little groups working within bigger organizations that are actually in place to protect the institution itself. And what's I've long found perplexing in the literature on IRBs is that often researchers and IRBs are seen as antagonistic, and it certainly feels that way on many campuses. And yet if you think about the literature on legal studies, you'd expect that there'd be more of a spirit or a feeling of partnership between the individuals who are the subject of the review or the subject of what the trustees are doing and the trustees themselves. So in thinking about and about control, you know, that literature and that language is often also associated with antagonistic relationships. And so in separating out control and the question of trust and trusting each other, it's more of a relationship that could go either way. They could be more or less trusting. And so the question is how people go about establishing trust. For me, the interesting thing is that this worked out in IRB meetings, in actual material things, in paper, in forms, in online applications that were getting sent in, and didn't actually happen through conversations or in-person meetings, which is how often situations of trust are studied. How do people look at each other or act together to make someone seem more or less trustworthy?
Okay.
And so what this meant was that if you're looking at forms and paper and material, it means that you're looking for someone's ability to actually have a lot of fluency with the language. And what this resulted in is a lot of implicit biases between people who, in the cases of the boards I was studying, weren't as fluent in English. Often they were not native English speakers. And so it produced, because those people would, there would occasionally be selections of people who would be brought in to meetings, or you'd have a sense of who they were. And it was clear that there was a patterning around having a sense of mistrust towards people who weren't native English speakers, which was the native language of the boards I was studying. Mm-hmm. And so I think that those sorts of unintended biases that end up being produced create some disadvantage and unfairness for particular researchers. And sometimes if there are systematic ways in which groups of people are studying particular health problems or problems in the social sciences, it can have sort of rippling effects.
During the course of your observations, did you encounter any positive methods by which an IRB reviewer would attempt to establish trust in an investigator?
Well, one of the things that IRBs often did, which was tremendously well-intended, and I actually endorse this approach, is trying to invite more investigators to have a conversation with an administrator or come to a meeting more often than not. But there's been some really interesting studies that have shown that this actually is on the rise. More IRBs are inviting investigators to meetings or into actual conversation, which seems like a good thing. But, of course, given the limits of time and also with, thankfully, more global research going on, these kinds of things aren't necessarily as feasible as it might seem. So I think that is one good step. However, oftentimes the issue with language problems also play out in in-person meetings anyway, and so it tends to actually amplify the differences and the difficulties. Mm-hmm. But one of the benefits is that you tend to IRB members and investigators were tend to better able to establish that they should be looking at the research itself as opposed to the delegation of the research tasks and these sorts of questions they could sort out in person.
So we should be looking at ways to turn the review process into a relationship or a conversation rather than let it remain simply behind closed doors, as it were.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it occurs to me that I should probably say a word or two about my own research methods. And so I'll just say that I did long-term observations and analysis of the conversations of full IRB meetings at three boards over the course of 1 year. And so this was what I was trying to do was make long-term observations at the same institutions over time so I could see how their decision-making processes developed and essentially unfolded over long periods of time, as opposed to using survey research, which of course is very valuable, but has own limits. And I found this to be a good complement, as well as interviews with all of the board members.
And your work is so fascinating because it's so timely. Much of what you touch on, both in your book and related publication, is related to points that were made during conversation about the AMPRM, back when we were talking about potential revisions to 45 CFR 46. And your current article deals with one of these points very specifically. You say toward the beginning that trustworthiness is not an explicit criterion for the assessment of the risks of research for subjects. And in many responses to the AMPRM, when those were solicited, people made that point pretty strenuously, that the regulations don't actually contain any guidance on what constitutes a trustworthy investigator or what qualities should define an adequate or ethical investigator. So what can we do differently? Do you think that moving forward the regs should include more description of investigator qualifications or qualities? Should more discussion about investigator qualities be part of the review process itself? What should we start thinking about to get away from some of the negative housekeeping and move into more effective trust-building patterns?
That's a great question. And in thinking about the AMPRM and then also just thinking about the next steps, I tend to be of the opinion that in putting in more refined language and more terminology, such as trust, which is itself something that then begs definition, simply has to be played out on the ground somehow in IRB meetings. So I'm not sure that legislating, writing administrative law about what indicators of trust should be taken into account and what shouldn't. I think that another really good option in thinking about what shifts trust and what makes relationships more fair is to think about the audience that has access to these conversations. So I think that the sense that what are typically at many institutions public meetings, that they are in effect private because people, researchers can't often attend IRB meetings, that shifting the audience is really one of the big ways to encouraging more trusting and I think more fair relationships between IRB members and investigators. So simple measures like being sure that at least minutes, but ideally something even more elaborate, I'd say detailed minutes, not quite transcripts of the points of the meetings that are would be appropriate to share. These kinds of things that would serve to shift the audience would go a long way in remedying some of these issues.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because trust goes both ways, doesn't it? And I feel like many times investigators don't trust the IRB because they're not aware of what actually transpires during the review process itself.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, so the sense of secrecy, even in these meetings that are at least technically public.
Well, thank you again for sharing with us what you're currently working on. I look forward to seeing what comes out of your sabbatical as well.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you all for joining us for More Than Meets the IRB. We would like to thank the Office for Public Affairs at Washington University School of Medicine for their generous ongoing support. See you next time.